It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farron. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we are in yet another polar vortex. We'll hear some suggestions from a Wisconsin author about books to read that'll actually make us appreciate winter.
First, it's time to turn our attention to Washington for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics and Congress editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time to share his insight into how politics really works in our nation's capital.
Yesterday, the top Republican on the Ways and Means Committee proposed a tax overhaul that's being scrutinized by Democrats and Republicans alike. It's the first big overhaul proposal in quite some time.
Also earlier this week, Congress's longest-serving member ever announced that he'll retire. Representative John Dingell has been in the office since the Eisenhower administration.
And Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel announced Monday that the U.S. military plans to downsize, especially the Army, to face new threats, a change that still has to go through Congress. Paul Singer, always a pleasure to have you here. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot. Great to be here with you guys.
Let's start with John Dingell, the longest-serving member of the U.S. Congress in history, as I understand it. What's the story, and why is he leaving now?
Well, he's 89 years old. He was first elected to Congress in 1955, taking a seat that had been held by his father. He, at this point, has said, essentially, he's tired of the Congress. He's tired of the conflict. He's tired of the inability to get stuff done, and it's time to move on. Dingell has had a hand in almost every major piece of legislation in the past, three or four decades. It's a pretty remarkable career.
Is it rare for somebody coming out of Congress? I can only think of a couple times that it's happened where they're so critical of the state of affairs in Congress.
Well, it's not rare this year. We've been hearing a lot of that. A lot of the people who have been retiring this year have said, basically, we can't get anything done. It's no fun anymore. Last year, we had a guy who left, a senator from South Carolina, who left to join the Heritage Foundation as the head of their kind of lobbying arm, saying, basically, I can get more done outside of Congress than I can inside Congress. So it's not all that uncommon at this point for members of Congress to say that what is really chasing them out is this sense that it's just not a lot of fun at this point.
He's being chased out, but as you said, his father was in this seat, and there's a word that his wife might run to replace him. So it's not it's too bad for him now, not for his spouse.
Yeah, Debbie Dingell, she's about 30 years younger than he is. I believe she's somewhere around 60. And she's been in Washington for a very long time as well. She has worked for a trade association, automobile association here in town for many years. She's a fixture here too. And I don't know, with a name like Dingell, she very might well win that seat. And it's possible that, for 100 years, that seat will be in one family.
Some of the talk I've seen here is this is yet another guy who had his partisan opinion, but he knew how to make deals. He knew how to compromise when he needed to. And Congress is losing that kind of people. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. Well, in fact, Congress is losing a lot of very experienced people, a lot of people with a long history. Something like 30% or 40% of the Congress now has only been in office for 3 or 4 years. I'll tell you, my favorite Dingell story was when several chairmen had to go testify about some budget bill. And at the hearing, the guy who was running the hearing says, well, I'll have the chairman start first. And everyone looked at each other and said, which chairman? And he said, oh, Mr. Big Chairman, by which he meant John Dingell. And that's how people viewed him. He was Mr. Big Chairman.
Well, we'll stay with Michigan. Michigan Republican Dave Camp made news yesterday. He unveiled a tax overhaul plan. What was he proposing?
Well, his proposal is really a sweeping overhaul of the tax code. He is recommending that we mash the current 7 different tax rates down into basically 2. The top rate for almost everybody would go drop down from 35% to 25% tax, with an exception for the very, very wealthiest, but basically 99% of taxpayers would pay in those two categories. He'd get rid of most itemized deductions. You'd have a standard deduction that would be larger and more generous, but you wouldn't have to itemize. He'd close a bunch of tax loopholes. He'd lower corporate taxes. I mean, it's every piece of the tax code would be affected. They actually said at one point there was 250 sections of the tax code that would just go away entirely. It's pretty dramatic and bold.
Is there broad agreement in Congress, obviously disagreement, I assume, in the particulars, but agreement on the idea that something needs to happen, there needs to be a substantial overhaul of the tax code?
You know, that's a really interesting question. Nobody wants to do this. The Senate leaders, both the Senate and the Democratic and the Republican leader in the Senate yesterday said this is not going to happen this year. John Boehner, the House Speaker, today said basically Mr. Camp's document is a discussion draft, worthwhile starting this conversation, but it ain't going to pass. And I think there is broad agreement that it is a good idea. There is broad agreement that it's time to fix the tax code. In some of the same ways that you and I have talked about before, there's kind of broad agreement that we need to get our handles on entitlements and figure out some sort of, you know, better way to budget our system. But there's just no real heart to get into this debate and pass a bill.
Is it that there's no heart in an election year to do it or ever?
There's certainly no heart in an election year. Ever is a really long time. But the last time there was a major overhaul of the tax code was 1986. I don't say it's undoable. I don't think it is undoable. And I think at some point it'll probably happen. But, you have to get to a point where there is a party in power in the House and in the Senate and in the White House where there is enough trust to really negotiate a deal. And I don't think that is the current situation here in Washington right now.
Is this something that people in Congress are looking and thinking, oh, our constituents are really into this? They really want a major overhaul of the tax code. Is it a sexy issue, or is this an eye glazer that people don't necessarily want to touch?
Yeah, it's hard. It is. I mean, once you get started on this conversation about tax code, you know, tax rates and brackets and deductions, everybody sort of glazes over. I think it is fair to say that everybody likes less taxes, and it's always fun for a lawmaker to be able to say, or a candidate to be able to say, I'm in favor of less tax. I think, you know, the issue here is, can you get the public engaged in the notion that our tax system has become too clunky, too difficult to manage, unfair in fundamental ways? Let's fix it. I don't know that anyone has really started that campaign yet, so I don't really know what we can gauge whether the American people really care.
A risk here is that if you put out a detailed plan, you're giving people a lot of ammunition against you. Is it at least significant that somebody said, hey, it maybe isn't going to happen, but here is a starting point for a discussion?
Well, I think that's where Camp deserves some real recognition. He actually did this with Max Baucus, who's the Democratic chair of the Finance Committee in the Senate. They've been doing this all year long. They've been sitting and negotiating this thing out all year long. They went on a bus tour around the country to talk to people about how should we reform the tax code. The problem is that Camp, as the chairman, he's term limited at the chairman of Ways and Means, so he's not likely to be in that seat at the end of this year. And Baucus is already gone. He was named ambassador to China a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, there's no champion for this effort now. But, yeah, you have to give them credit for sitting down and putting on paper the first major overhaul, or at least proposal to overhaul the tax code in a generation.
Paul Singer is with us. He's with USA Today. He's their politics and Congress editor. We'll pick up more congressional issues coming up, including minimum wage laws in Arizona that some people are saying discriminatory may enter into the congressional race, and the size of the military. That's all coming up in just a few. We're back with USA Today politics and Congress editor Paul Singer. We're discussing happenings in Congress this week. Another big discussion going on in Congress, Paul, the response to the announcement earlier this week from the Secretary of Defense on cutting the size of the Army, other parts of the military. Cutting military bases in congressional districts, I know, is always really popular with the people who represent those districts, right?
Yeah, well, in fact, Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, said he has asked for a round of base closures, and basically Congress said, forget about it. So that's not going to happen. The interesting challenge will be how do you shrink the budget for the Pentagon over time without shrinking the number of facilities? And they don't really have an answer for that yet.
Have you seen response from people in Congress to the plan that the secretary floated?
Well, you know, there has been an ongoing discussion in Congress about the levels, the proper levels for defense spending. I think it's clear that the size of the force is shrinking. And keep in mind, part of the reason it's shrinking is because of cuts in the budget that Congress themselves kicked off with the sequester a year or so ago. So I don't think anybody argues the point that there's going to be a tighter defense budget and probably a smaller force. Where you'll get into the arguments is when you try to shut down a particular weapon system or you try to shut down a particular facility. Obviously, then there is a constituency directly affected that can leap up and down and say, no. But we won't get to that for a little while because Congress still has to basically chew this over and come up with their own version of the budget. You know, these documents out of the administration are really just sort of statements of principle. They don't have any direct effect other than this is what we would like to do.
Well, one thing affecting us here in Wisconsin, there's been a response from at least one of our senators here. One of the cuts would be toward orders of ships, coastal combat ships that are built here in Wisconsin, and worries about how that'll affect the job situation.
Right. Well, every one of these cuts, any cut in the Pentagon budget, directly comes back to a contractor somewhere. That's, you know, the magic trade-off. That's one of the reasons why they like to do these things in big packages, so that they can, you know, trade off your pain for my pain. But it's very hard to do. And you know, even when they do, you know, sort of a formal base closing kind of commission, it becomes this very painful process because ultimately somebody's going to lose. But you sort of reverse the question, you know, for your listeners, is it worth it to them to save $100 billion a year in defense cuts, you know, in defense spending, for instance, if the part of the outcome is we're going to lose, what, 150 or 250 local jobs? Is that the trade-off that we're worth making? It's a really hard thing to do.
Here's an issue we talked about yesterday on the show. Arizona is getting a lot of attention for a bill that some people describe as a religious freedom bill, others an anti-LGBT rights bill. It would allow business owners to decline to serve customers based on religious grounds. Some people see that targeting gays, lesbians, and others. There have been threats of boycotts of Arizona if that becomes law. Key Republicans, including the two senators from Arizona, have said, hey, Jan Brewer, governor of Arizona, veto that bill. Is this giving us any insight how LGBT issues will play out in the midterm elections?
It's an interesting question. I mean, you know, even Mitt Romney came out last night and opposed this bill, said it should be vetoed. You know, depends on where you live. I think it would probably be a hard thing for a Republican in some of the northern climes, you know, in New York, possibly even in Madison, Wisconsin, to say that I favor a bill that allows for this, you know, for a company to decline service to a gay couple, for instance. However, in Alabama, maybe they can get away with it. It depends on where you are. I think the long and the short of it is, it is clear that the trend now is towards more rights and public recognition for gay and lesbian couples and for gays and lesbians in general. I think that is just where the country is trending. But it's not all there yet, and so there will be issues where, or places where, this will still be a battle and a bitter one fought out at the polls.
I know, as you say, it'll vary state to state, but on a national level, is there one party or the other hoping this will or won't be an issue or related issues that come up in the election?
Well, you know, since there's not a national election, as it were, this year, again, I think it'll be a bigger deal state by state. There will be some Senate races where this might play out. There is a Senate race in Georgia where the candidates are primarily competing for who can be most conservative, right? They might endorse this bill. Senate races, again, in Arkansas may be the same deal. Iowa, maybe not so much. I mean, it really is a state by state issue in that case. And again, part of the issue is that each state has taken a different approach to gay marriage, but the courts now, even in Texas, which is no liberal bastion, has overturned a ban on gay marriage. So, I mean, I think, again, it will play in elections, but it'll play in elections very differently depending on where you live, and at the moment, it's pretty clear the trend is towards more rights for gays.
Well, speaking of trends, a growing trend in the country is dislike or lack of confidence in Congress. We see a new Fox News poll showing that Congress has the least confidence of any institution they asked about in the United States. Just 5% of Americans have a great deal of confidence in Congress, and a minority has some confidence in it. We've seen polls like this, but is there any way that Congress can dig itself out of this this crisis of its identity in the nation?
you know, I feel good about those polls because they make reporters look good by comparison. this is where we're at this time. I mean, Mitt Romney was right. You know, 47% will embrace his side of the agenda. 47% are going to embrace Barack Obama's side of the agenda, basically to knee jerk. And as long as that is the case, we are that divided a country and that narrowly divided a country. It will be hard to make progress on large issues because you don't have an overwhelming consensus on large issues. When that happens, you end up with a Congress that everybody hates. But I'll tell you that, you know, the trend has been in those numbers for Congress has been better over the past couple of months. Back in October when the government shut down, you know, there were sexually transmitted diseases that had a better approval rating than Congress, literally. In the past couple of months, Congress is no longer listed as the biggest problem in America, which, again, that's better than it was. So, you know, these trends kind of ebb and flow. The fact of the matter is we are in a time of divided government, and that spawns this sense of dissatisfaction. My suggestion to everybody is if you're unhappy with the guy who, the woman who is currently representing you in Congress, run against him. Get out and vote, get out and tell people, and try and make a difference. Maybe that's how it changes.
Paul, thanks a lot. Look forward to talking to you again next week.
Yep, we'll talk to you soon.
That's Paul Singer, USA Today politics and Congress editor. He joins us each Wednesday at this time to talk Congress. He tweets at Singer News. We've been outside today, and we know it's still winter. As much as we'd rather be running around in shorts right about now, it's not going to happen, at least this week, so we've decided to try and embrace the season.
If you have polar vortex fatigue, it may be that our next guest can help. James Campbell is with us now to talk about books that make you love winter. James is a Wisconsin writer and the author of The Final Frontiersman. James, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So last time we talked with you, there was a polar vortex settled over Wisconsin.
Right.
We speak again in the grip of yet another polar vortex, and I know everyone's got spring fever, but it seems as though we just need to make peace with winter now. So we thought we'd talk to you about books that really get at the beauty of winter and what there is to love about it. What do you turn to when you want to go for a beautiful winter read?
Well, I particularly love a book by James Galvin called The Meadow. And Galvin is first and foremost a poet, and he sets his book in a meadow on a ranch on the Wyoming Colorado border, and he takes us through all the seasons, but his style is spare and beautiful and lyrical, and it's especially beautiful when he describes winter. And there's another poet named John Haynes who is the former Alaskan poet laureate, and he lived in a trapping cabin in the Alaskan wilderness for 25 years. And he's also a poet, and he wrote a book called The Stars, the Snow, and the Fire, which is absolutely beautiful.
What do you think it takes to make a book that writes about winter really sing?
Well, I think that apart from the obvious, you know, kind of cruelty and brutality of winter that we all feel on a day like today. In fact,
yep.
I was just walking with my daughter and I ran inside and said, man, that weather and that wind is just too brutal. But I think that it takes, in many cases, kind of a poet's eye and a poet's ability to observe and not only observe, but capture those observations with language or in language as Haynes and Galvin do so wonderfully.
Well, we're going to talk more about some of your recommendations for wonderful winter reading. And in the meantime, you can go over to our Central Time Facebook page and share some of your favorite reads that really evoke winter and make you sort of appreciate what there is to appreciate in winter, the frostiness, the chill, the darkness, and the coziness that can go along with that. And James, I think you've read the same book I have, North to the Night by Alva Simon. Is that one you've read?
Yeah, I have. Well, I haven't read the entire thing. In fact, I thought I'd read it, and when we talked last, you mentioned that it was one of your favorite books. So I thought, oh my gosh, this is one I hadn't read. So I just began it. I've just begun it, and
uh-huh.
It's a beautiful book, and obviously, you know, about personal transformation, too.
Right. And in that book is about, it's a true story of a husband and wife who sail above the Arctic Circle. And the husband winters there in his sailboat, which is equipped over the winter, you know, time of zero daylight. And I remember reading that during these long, dark days, snuggled up. And the storms, the winter storms here in Wisconsin were raging outside. And I really felt like I was part of it.
Yeah.
And the snowiness, the whiteness, the coldness, you could really feel it because, you know, in a sense, I was feeling it. Here I was in similar conditions. But I think that can be something that really makes you rethink how you think about winter, that it is this sort of beautiful kind of epic season.
Particularly from the comfort of a house or
exactly.
in front of a warm
right.
fire. I think that winter is often observed from indoors looking out. And that gives one kind of a comfortable and cozy feeling. But to be out in it, as he was, and as many other writers have been, is a different thing.
Now, one that you mentioned recently as we were emailing back and forth was the Little House books.
Yeah, I love the Little House books. I started a tradition in the house. Let's see, my oldest daughter is 15 now. When she was 5, I began reading to her every morning before school, and I have 3 daughters and do that with all of them now. And their favorites are the Little House books, and of course The Little House in the Big Woods is just so wonderfully done.
And there's one of those in the series is, I think, The Long Winter, isn't it?
Yeah, The Long Winter, that's the one set on the North Dakota plains, right? When the town runs out of food.
Mm-hmm.
And that paints a little bit a kind of a more brutal portrait of winter than Little House in the Big Woods. You know, to be out on the plains with the howling, you know, bitterly cold winds, I think is a different thing. But the picture she paints in Little House in the Big Woods is one of comfort and kind of childlike joy at winter.
In some of these, at least, you know that if you're suffering here in winter, other people have suffered through winters too, and you've got company in getting through winter. And I guess the Little House books give a little both. You think of the comfort and also sort of the starkness of winter on the other hand. Well, let's talk about another of those that you love, one called The Snow Child.
Oh, yeah, it's a beautiful book. A friend introduced it to me when we were in Alaska. My daughter and I were in Alaska this summer. And he asked me if I'd ever read The Snow Child, and I hadn't. And it's by a woman, and her first name is a Gaelic name. I think it's Yon Ivey. And it was a national bestseller, and one of the reviewers said it was kind of a mixture of Willa Cather or Laura Ingalls Wilder and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, kind of this a very lyrical book, but also tinged with this kind of magical realism. And her language is also beautiful.
Oh, that sounds like a lovely one. And we were talking around the office here, another one that came up, probably maybe not one to make you love winter, but makes you understand just how brutal it can be, Game of Thrones. Lots of wintertime scenes with the sort of zombie-like White Walkers roaming the land. And I also thought of the Golden Compass in terms of fantasy, which takes place in the North.
Uh-huh. Well, I have not read either of those, so I can't comment. But certainly there are countless books about winter. In fact, I'm sitting here looking at my bookshelf, and another one of my favorites is Rick Bass's Winter. And I love Rick Bass's fiction, but this is one of his early books when he's a greenhorn from Mississippi, and he and his wife move to the remote Yaak Valley of Montana from Mississippi. And it's a really lyrical book, and it's a very funny book as he, you know, kind of watching his misadventures as he prepares for the cold Montana winter to set in.
And is that one nonfiction or fiction?
No, that one's nonfiction.
Nonfiction. James, you've spent a lot of time in severe winter weather in the Arctic of Alaska with your daughter. Do you think that there is something to winter that makes us stronger, better people?
Yeah, I think I'm kind of a winter guy. If my wife had her way, we'd be living in Costa Rica. If I had my way, we'd be living on the Yukon River. So we met somewhere in the middle here in Wisconsin. But yeah, I think that winter, of course, it's full of hardships, and in the Arctic in particular, it's full of hardships and dangers. And but when you live there, as we did with my cousin, those hardships are, you know, part of your everyday routine. So it doesn't matter if it's 50 below and the wind is howling down the river valley. You still have to go and break ice on the river and then haul water. You know, you can't. The wood stove is wonderful, but you come back in, you go out and come back in, warm up at the wood stove, and then go out and assume your daily chores.
Now you've got another book that you recommend in all the Leopold selection. Lots of us know it here, A Sam Cody Almanac.
Yeah, I think Leopold does a wonderful job with winter. And actually, we have a little festival here in Lodi called Lodi Reads Leopold, which is coming up in March. It was started by a former Lodi resident, a friend of mine, and a UW professor named Tom Heberlein. And we celebrate throughout March and the first weekend in March all things Leopold. And we read the book, A Sand County Almanac, from cover to cover. And it becomes very apparent that Elda Leopold loved Wisconsin, loved Wisconsin seasons, but also was a lover of winter, though I think there's a chapter in which he talks about the return of the cranes and the geese, which he looks upon, hopefully. And he has a great line where he says about the arriving geese, their arrival carries the conviction of a prophet who has burned his bridges, which I think is a wonderful line. But, yeah, we have another John Muir, also a Wisconsinite, who also loved winter. And I was thinking of one quote in particular, and he's looking with delight at the approaching winter and getting back to looking at winter from, you know, the coziness of a house. He says, "You're looking at the wondrous storms when I would be warmly snowbound in my Yosemite cabin with plenty of bread and books."
Ah, oh, that does sound nice.
Yeah.
See, I guess winter has an upside after all, huh?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I'll be ready for spring in about another month, but not yet.
All right. Well, it's good to talk to you, a winter evangelist, to get us excited about what's left
like
of winter.
That. Thank you.
James, thanks so much for joining us again.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
We've been talking to James Campbell. He's a Wisconsin writer. He's the author of the book, The Final Frontiersman.